Condiments go, squeeze bottles are another lifesaver. Sure, you can fill them with the standards, mustard, ketchup, and mayo, and of course, you save money by buying those things in bulk instead of in individual squeezy containers. They are also great for saving money on all kinds of sauces and oils. I buy olive oil, sesame oil, soy sauce, hoisin sauce, oyster sauce, tonkatsu sauce, and chinkiang vinegar, to name a few, in big cans. Then I just store the cans out of the way under the sink or in the closet and refill my squeeze bottles as needed. It'll make the inside of your refrigerator look all cool, organized, and chefy as well. Want to throw a fancy cocktail party? Squeeze bottles are your friend. Fill a big one with simple syrup, smaller ones with fresh-squeezed citrus juices or flavored syrups. You'll be cleaner, neater, and more efficient, cutting the time it takes to make each cocktail by a not insignificant degree, and your guests will marvel at how pro you look. As far as buying them goes, no need to get fancy. I picked up a couple dozen at a Chinese restaurant supply store. Amazon sells them for a few bucks apiece. Buy a half dozen and see if they don't change your life for the better. And yeah, like Tony says, you can use them to make your plates all frou-frou if you desire. Weight versus volume. You may notice that in most cases, the baking recipes in this book are given with weight measurements, ounces and pounds, as opposed to volume measurements, cups and spoons. Why is that? First and foremost, accuracy. Volume measurements are simply not accurate. To prove this, I asked 10 friends of mine to measure out a cup of flour from a bowl. Each person used the same measuring cup dipped into the same bowl of flour. I even had each of them use the same method, dipping the cup into the bowl, then leveling off the excess with a knife. Then I weighed each batch. The difference was astounding. The cups of flour ranged from as low as 4 ounces to as high as 6 ounces, depending on the force used while scooping. That means that one person in this group would end up using a full 50% more flour than the person with the lightest cup for the same recipe. If, on the other hand, I'd asked each person to weigh out 5 ounces of flour, my standard conversion for a cup of all-purpose flour, there'd be no problem at all. Each person would weigh out exactly the same amount, regardless of how they handled a cup measure. With its fluffy texture and easy-to-aerate nature, flour is probably the most extreme example of this lack of correlation between volume and weight. But it extends to other ingredients as well. Easy cleanup. Think of it this way. To make a pizza crust recipe that calls for a couple cups of flour, a half teaspoon of salt, a tablespoon of olive oil, a cup of water, and a teaspoon of yeast using volume measures requires you to dirty, at the very least, a mixing bowl, a dry cup measure, a liquid cup measure, a half teaspoon measure, a tablespoon measure, and a full teaspoon measure. Total items to wash, 6. Not too nice. Here's how I make my pizza crust. Place the bowl on the scale and weigh the required ingredients one at a time directly into the bowl. Total items to wash, 1. Get it? Measuring sticky items is easy. Ever try and measure out, say, 2 teaspoons of honey? It's not easy. Sure, getting the honey into the teaspoon measure is simple enough. It's getting it out that's the problem. You end up either getting about half of it out and eyeballing an extra squirt or so directly from the bottle, or, if you're anything like I used to be, you end up with most of the honey stuck to your finger as you try to scoop it out in desperation. With a kitchen scale and volume measurements, fretting about sticky ingredients is a thing of the past. Here's the thing. We all grew up in this country using volume measurements instead of weight. We also, unfortunately, grew up without a firm grasp of the metric system, a system of measurement vastly superior to our ridiculous feet, inches, cups, and gallons. It might be harder to convince people to switch to metrics, but using weights instead of volume should be a no-brainer for anyone. Trust me, buy yourself a good kitchen scale. The basic pantry. The pantry is the backbone of your kitchen. Many beginning cooks are intimidated by recipes because of the sheer number of ingredients that need to be purchased the first time they cook something. But pancakes are a convenient food precisely because they are made from ingredients you pretty much always have on hand. Imagine having to buy flour, butter, eggs, buttermilk, baking powder, sugar, oil, and vanilla extract every single time you wanted to make pancakes. I like to keep a well-stocked kitchen, and, as such, my pantry is a large one. I recently completely emptied my kitchen shelves and refrigerator and reorganized them, in the process cataloging every pantry item I had into a single document that lives online, where I can access it at any time to see exactly what I have to work with. What? Doesn't everybody do that? I came up with 357 different food items, including 8 types of salt and 63 different spices. Yikes! There's no need for you to keep a pantry that large, but every kitchen should be stocked with some basics. Here you'll find some tips on how to best use your refrigerator, as well as a list of ingredients that'll help you get through most of the recipes in this book with only the need to purchase perishable ingredients fresh. I divided it into refrigerated goods, baking supplies, grains, canned goods, spices, and what I call wet pantry items. Refrigerated goods. Like cell phones and clean underwear, a refrigerator is one of those things that you never really consider the importance of until it stops doing its job, like mine did last week. Organizing your fridge for maximum efficiency in terms of food shelf life, food safety, and easy access to the things you reach for most should be a top priority. It'll make all of your cooking projects go faster and more easily, and having more fun in the kitchen inevitably leads to more cooking. That's a good thing in my book. A fridge is basically just a big cold box with a few shelves in it, right? Well, that's true. But where you store food in the fridge can have quite an impact on its shelf life. Most refrigerators have cold and hot spots, with temperatures that range from 33 degrees to 38 degrees Fahrenheit or so. In general, the back of the bottom shelf, where cooler, heavier air falls to, and the back of the top shelf, closest to the fan and condenser, are the coldest spots, while the middle of the door is the warmest. How you organize your food in the fridge should be based on how cold it needs to be kept. First, some basic tips on getting the most out of your fridge space on a daily basis. Get a fridge thermometer. There are a number of things that can cause your fridge to break down or lose power: electrical shorts or surges, clogged ventilation, etc. So it's possible that even with your temperature dial adjusted to the correct position, your fridge might be far warmer than it should be. A simple dial thermometer helps you monitor things to ensure that you're never caught in the dark. Transfer food to smaller containers. I keep a stack of half-pint, pint, and quart plastic deli containers to store almost all food once it comes out of the original packaging. Air is the enemy of most foods and can increase their rate of spoilage. By transferring them to smaller containers, you not only minimize air contact, but you also help keep your fridge organized and easy to navigate. Label everything. As soon as you transfer food into a smaller storage container, label the container using permanent marker on masking tape with the date of storage, as well as what's inside. As much as I promote good science, there are some things that simply aren't worth experimenting with. Creating life inside your refrigerator is one of them. Prevent drippage. To avoid messes and dangerous cross-contamination, always store raw meat, no matter how well wrapped, on a plate or a tray to catch any drips. Keep fish extra cold. It's best to use fresh fish immediately, but if you must store it, wrap it in plastic and sandwich it between 2 ice packs on a tray to ensure that it stays at 32 degrees Fahrenheit or colder until ready to use. Don't worry, because of dissolved solids in its cell structure, it won't freeze until well below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Where to store food in the refrigerator? There are 3 overriding factors to consider when deciding what to store where in the fridge. Food safety is of utmost importance. Fridges keep food fresh for longer, but that doesn't mean that harmful bacteria can't multiply to dangerous levels given enough time. To minimize risk, here's a rule of thumb. The more likely the possibility of food could make you sick, and the higher the final temperature you intend to cook it to, the lower in the refrigerator it should be stored, both to keep it cooler and to prevent cross-contamination. For instance, don't store raw chicken above leftovers from the night before. Juices from the bird can drip down unnoticed, contaminating your food. Temperature varies throughout your refrigerator, with, as mentioned earlier, either the very back of the bottom shelf or the back of the top shelf near the vent being the coldest spot, depending on the model. For maximum storage life, your refrigerator should be set to hold a minimum temperature of 34 degrees Fahrenheit in these spots. No part of your refrigerator should rise above 39 degrees Fahrenheit. Humidity plays a role in the freshness of vegetables. The crisper drawers in the bottom of your refrigerator are designed to prevent fresh, cold air from circulating into them. Vegetables naturally emit a bit of energy as they go about their normal energy cycles, heating up the space in the drawer, thus enabling it to retain more moisture. Moist air can help prevent vegetables from shriveling or drying out. Most crisper drawers have a slider that controls the ventilation so that you can adjust the moisture level inside the drawer. The key is to maximize it up to just below the point that moisture would start beating up on the vegetable's surfaces. To give you an idea of good refrigerator storage organization, allow me to take you on a little tour of my fridge. Here's what you'll usually find there. The main compartment. The top shelf. Ready-to-eat prepared foods. Roasted red peppers, jarred tomatoes, a can of white asparagus, sun-dried tomatoes. Ready-to-eat condiments that I don't use too often. A variety of Chinese bean and chili pastes, curry paste, a half can of coconut milk, cans or jars of tahini, harissa, tomato paste, chipotles and adobo, olive tapenade, anchovies. Pickled products. Dill spears and chips, bread and butter pickles, ramps, jalapenos, capers, olives. Fridge-friendly fruits like apples, oranges, berries, melons, and grapes. The middle shelf. Leftovers in sealed containers. Leftover mac and cheese, a few pieces of roasted chicken, my dog's food, braised asparagus, pizza sauce, salsa. Cheese, in its original packaging, or wrapped in parchment and stored in a sealed baggie. A half hunk of goat's milk Gouda, crumbled cotija, homemade American cheese slices, sharp cheddar, a big hunk of Parmesan, Gorgonzola. Eggs in their carton. If it takes you more than a couple of weeks to go through a carton of eggs, store them on the back of this shelf, where it's a little cooler to maximize shelf life. Otherwise, you can keep them in the door, despite what anyone tells you. They'll keep for at least a few weeks, even in this relatively warmer environment. Cold cuts and sandwich bread. Martin's potato rolls. Arnold multigrain bread. Sliced sandwich bread will keep fine in the fridge. However, lean breads like baguettes or Italian-style breads should be stored at room temperature or in the freezer. The refrigerator will promote staling. The bottom shelf. Raw meat and poultry wrapped carefully and on a plate. Ground beef, skirt steak, fresh pork belly, Italian sausage. Raw fish in its wrapper and placed on a tray. I buy my fish the day it's going to be consumed, and you should too. Milk and other dairy products. Heavy cream, sour cream, cottage cheese, homemade creme fraiche, buttermilk. The vegetable crisper. Vegetables, stored in breathable plastic bags or plastic bags with the tops left slightly open. Broccoli, celery, carrots, cucumbers, scallions, asparagus, radishes, turnips. Herbs. Parsley, cilantro, chives, thyme, rosemary, basil in the summer. I wash and pick my herbs as soon as they get home, then store them rolled up in damp paper towels in plastic Ziploc bags. The fridge door. The fridge door is the best place to store frequently used items and those that don't require the coldest temperature. The top shelf. Eggs, if you go through a carton within a few weeks. Butter and frequently used cheeses. Cabot 83 unsalted butter, inexpensive Danish blue, love it on toast, brie, and other soft cheeses. Butter stays slightly softer in the fridge door, which makes it easier to spread on toast. If you eat a lot of cheese, you might want to store it here as well, so that it's not quite as cold when you grab it. The middle shelf. Condiments in their original packaging or in squeeze bottles if homemade. Ketchup, chili sauce, several types of mustard, homemade mayo, Japanese barbecue sauce. Premixed vinaigrettes in squeeze bottles. Simple red wine vinaigrette, soy balsamic vinaigrette. The bottom shelf. Drinks. Whole milk, freshly squeezed pineapple juice, pitchers of chilled tap water, the occasional cheer wine or Mexican Coke. Milk should go on a shelf in the main fridge compartment if you don't use much, but for daily drinkers, the door is a fine place for it, as it is for juices, sodas, etc. The freezer. Everyone, of course, keeps frozen meats and vegetables in the freezer, but it's also an excellent place to store any heat or light-sensitive items that might go rancid. In my freezer, aside from meat and veg, you'll find nuts, which can be toasted or crushed straight out of the freezer, cured meats like salt pork, bacon, and guanciale, dried bay leaves, I buy them in bulk, chicken stock frozen in 1-cup portions, breadcrumbs, extra butter, yeast, sausage casings, whole grain flours, they contain fats that can turn rancid at room temp, and fresh pasta, among other things. Here are some tips for better freezer storage. Keep your vents clear. Make sure you don't stack food against the air vents, or you'll strain the freezer, greatly reducing its efficiency and efficacy. Transfer meat from its original packaging. To prevent freezer burn, as well as to freeze the meat as quickly as possible, the faster it freezes, the less damage it will incur in the process, transfer it to flat, airtight packaging. Best of all is to use a vacuum sealer like a food saver, which will completely eliminate the possibility of freezer burn. Next best is to wrap the meat tightly in foil, followed by several layers of plastic wrap. Plastic wrap on its own will be air permeable, or to use a freezer bag designed for long-term storage. Freeze flat. Wide, flat shapes freeze faster and can be stacked more efficiently than bulky packages. Freeze meats in a single layer in vacuum-sealed packages or freezer bags. Not only will this help you organize your freezer space, it'll also greatly cut down on defrosting time. Label everything. All packages should have the contents and date written on them. Nobody likes to play the frozen mystery guessing game. Defrost safely. The best way to safely defrost meat is on a plate or a rimmed baking sheet in the refrigerator. Be aware that it'll probably take longer than you think. Allow at least overnight for thin items like steaks, burgers, chicken breasts, and the like. Up to 2 days for beef and pork roasts or whole chickens, and up to 3 or even 4 days for large turkeys. In emergencies, thinner foods can be rapidly defrosted by placing them in a bowl of cold water under a slowly running tap, or, better yet, placed on an aluminum tray or pan, which will very quickly transmit energy from the room to the food. Steaks will defrost about 50% faster on an aluminum tray than on a wooden or plastic cutting board. Turn them over every half hour or so as they thaw. Do not try to defrost large items rapidly. The risk of dangerous bacteria growing on the exterior before the interior defrosts is too great. Essential pantry ingredients. Cold pantry. Here are the refrigerated items I have on hand at all times. Bacon, slab, will last several weeks in the fridge, can be frozen for longer storage. Butter, unsalted, will last several weeks in the fridge. I keep a few extra pounds in the freezer where it will keep indefinitely. Buttermilk. Cheese, Parmigiano Reggiano. Eggs, large. Ketchup. Maple syrup, Grade A dark amber. Mayonnaise. Milk, whole or 2%, or if you must, skim. Mustard, Dijon. Mustard, brown. Baking pantry. Some people are bakers, some are not. I wasn't born a baker, but I've discovered that after organizing my baking pantry, making bread and pastry has become far more pleasurable for me. I used to store my flours and such in their original bags in a cabinet. To bake something, I'd have to pull everything out, try and measure out of a paper bag with a narrow opening, and finally end up folding the bag back down, forcing it to release a puff of flour that'd get all over my clothes and kitchen. Baking was a chore. Then I decided to invest in a couple of large, sealable, wide-mouthed plastic tubs to store basic pantry items such as flours and sugar. This allows me to quickly and easily scoop up as much flour as I need without making a mess. These days, I make many more pizzas than I used to. All of the items in the chart in the bonus PDF should be stored in a cool, dry place, first transferred to a sealed container if appropriate. Whole wheat versus refined white flour. A kernel of wheat is a pretty complicated thing, but as far as cooking is concerned, it can be divided into three basic parts: the endosperm, the hull, and the germ. Whole wheat flour is exactly what it sounds like: the entire grain from the wheat plant, ground up. Refined white flour contains only the starchy, proteinaceous sections from the endosperm, with all of the hull and germ removed. Why would anyone want to do that? It's all about gluten formation. We'll be talking quite a bit about gluten in this book, but for now, all you need to know is that gluten is the stretchy matrix of proteins that gives doughs their flexibility. It's formed when the proteins gliadin and glutenin, found in the endosperm, are mixed together in the presence of water. White flour is excellent at developing gluten, delivering breads that are fluffy, chewy, and well risen. Whole wheat breads, on the other hand, tend to be dense and relatively dry. This is because ground-up sections of the hull and germ act sort of like tiny razor blades, snipping through the developing gluten and preventing individual strands from growing too long. You can substitute whole wheat flours in recipes if you'd like, but don't expect to get that same light, well-risen breads you'd achieve with white flour. Grains and legumes. Grains and legumes should be stored in a cool, dry place. Beans will keep from 6 months to a year, while regular pasta and white rice will last indefinitely. Whole wheat pasta and brown rice will go rancid after extended storage, usually 6 to 8 months. Smell them before using. If there is any hint of a fishy aroma, discard. Beans, dried, black. Beans, dried, cannellini. Beans, dried, kidney. Pasta, lasagna. Pasta, short and holy, like elbows or penne. Pasta, long, like linguine or spaghetti. Rice, white or brown. Canned goods. Canned goods will last almost indefinitely, but it's better not to expose them to severe temperature fluctuations. Anchovies, oil-packed. After the container has been opened, anchovies can be stored in a sealed container under a layer of olive oil in the fridge for up to a month. For longer storage, roll up individual fillets, transfer to a Ziploc freezer bag, and store in the freezer. I use Ortiz or Agostino Reca brand. Chipotle chilies, packed in adobo sauce. Evaporated milk. Tomato paste. I buy my tomato paste in tubes as opposed to cans, so that I can use only what is needed for a recipe, without having to find a way to store the excess. Tomatoes, whole canned. I use Cento brand. Spices and salts. Do you have a can of paprika or oregano in your kitchen that's been around since He-Man and MacGyver were still on television? Do yourself a favor. Throw it out. Spices lose their flavor over time, even when stored in sealed containers out of direct sunlight, as they should be. Whole spices may keep for up to a year or so without significant flavor loss, but pre-ground spices will become noticeably less flavorful in a matter of months. For the best flavor, you have two options. The first is to buy your spices whole and in small batches, replacing them every 6 months to a year or so. The alternative is to buy whole spices in bulk, keeping small amounts of them in jars in your spice rack, and storing the remainder in vacuum-sealed pouches, like those for a food saver-type vacuum sealer, in a cool, dark place, or, preferably, in the freezer. Salt will last forever, so long as it's kept dry. Bay leaves, whole, stored in the freezer. Black peppercorns. Chili powder. Cinnamon, ground. Coriander seeds. Cumin seeds. Fennel seeds. Nutmeg, whole. Paprika. Red pepper, crushed. Oregano, dried. Sage, dried. Salt, kosher. Salt, Malden. Oils, vinegars, and other liquids. Oils are the most sensitive wet pantry item in your kitchen. Stored badly, they can go rancid within a span of weeks. The enemies of oil are heat and light, which means that the way most people store them, in clear bottles close to the stove, is just about the worst thing you can do. I store my cooking oil and everyday extra virgin olive oil in dark green wine bottles that I've washed and dried, fitted with inexpensive pour spouts for the purpose. They stay on my counter, far away from the window and the stove. The oils last for about a month in those containers before I refill them. I keep expensive extra virgin olive oils in their original containers in a dark cabinet where they will last for about 2 months. Remember, there's no point in having great olive oil if you don't use it before it starts to lose flavor or go rancid. I've learned this the hard way. Olive oil's for eating, no matter how expensive it is. Eat it. Honey, clover, Marmite, Vegemite, or Maggi seasoning, molasses, regular, oil, canola, for sautéing, oil, extra virgin olive, for flavoring, oil, peanut, for deep frying, soy sauce. If you won't use up a bottle within 2 months, store it in the refrigerator. I use the Kikkoman brand. Vinegar, cider. Vinegar, balsamic, supermarket. Vinegar, distilled white. Vinegar, white wine. Which salt should I use? These days, you see more types of salt on supermarket shelves than there are tools under Inspector Gadget's trench coat. But really, there's only one that you absolutely need in your kitchen. Kosher salt. I use Diamond Crystal brand because I like the size of its grains. For the record, kosher salt is not called kosher because it's okay to eat under Jewish dietary law. All salt is kosher in that sense. Kosher salt should really be called koshering salt because its large grains efficiently draw blood out from flesh during the koshering process, which, by the way, makes it an extremely efficient salt for dry brining. More on that later. Why use kosher salt over regular table salt? One word, sprinkling. Table salt is fine if you use it out of a salt shaker, but you get a much better idea of how much salt you're actually putting into or on your food if you add the salt with your fingers, and kosher salt is simply easier to pick up and apply that way. To apply an even layer of salt to your food, pick up a pinch of kosher salt, then hold your hand high above the food before sprinkling it. Because of turbulence in the air, your salt will rain down upon your food in a pattern that shows a normal bell curve distribution from where you drop it. The higher you drop it from, the more even the distribution. All of the recipes in this book were tested with Diamond Crystal kosher salt. If you must use table salt, you should only use 2/3 as much as is called for, as table salt packs more tightly into a measuring spoon. Most of the time, it's called for in amounts too small to effectively measure with a scale. In most savory recipes, you'll be able to taste the salt level as you cook, adjusting it to suit your own palate. Whenever appropriate, for baking projects, brines, etc., I've given salt measurements in weight. And what about all the fancy designer salts? The pink or black ones? The grayish sea salt from Guérande in France that comes in big, moist clusters, or the white, pyramid-shaped Maldon sea salt from England? I have a bad habit of collecting them, partly because they're pretty and I like the way they look on my food, but mostly just to compete with my wife's shoe collection. One new salt per pair of shoes seems to keep her shopping habit at bay. But what are they good for? These are all finishing salts, salts that are meant to be applied just before serving or even at the table. Despite claims to the contrary, you'll find that flavor-wise, there is almost no difference between these salts and regular or kosher salt. Dissolve the same weights of the stuff into glasses of water, and they all become essentially identical. It's their shape that makes them interesting, the crunch and intense burst of, well, saltiness that they provide. Think you won't notice the difference? Go out and get yourself a box of Maldon sea salt, the finishing salt that I use most often, a box of kosher salt, and a box of regular table salt. Then place 3 identical slices of ripe tomato on a plate, or if you prefer, 3 identical slices of steak. Sprinkle a bit of table salt on the first and eat it. Next, sprinkle some kosher salt on the second and eat it. Notice the difference? See how much more easily you can sprinkle the salt evenly across the surface of the food? Finally, sprinkle a few shards of Maldon salt on the last and eat it. Notice the crackle of salt crystals under your teeth and the accompanying burst of flavor? That's why I keep kosher salt next to my stove and cutting board and a large crystal sea salt on my dining room table. 1. Eggs, dairy, and the science of breakfast. Is there any food so perfect, so complete, so profoundly simple, yet staggeringly complex as the egg? It's easily the most versatile and useful ingredient in the pantry. Just think of what you can do with eggs. You can eat them fried, scrambled, soft-boiled, hard-boiled, poached, baked, or turned into an omelet. They make the breading stick to your chicken parm. Their proteins can be set into a dense matrix that thickens custards or whipped into an airy foam that leavens batters. They can bring together your meatloaf without weighing it down, or act as culinary ambassadors, helping turn oil and water into a stable, creamy mayonnaise. All this, and they come in their own convenient, easy-to-measure, easy-to-store packaging to boot. They practically sell themselves. Eggs are truly a marvel, and it's no wonder that their culinary uses are so varied. Just think, given fertilization and enough time, an entire living, breathing creature can be formed from the contents of an eggshell. The start of life, the start of many recipes. I can't think of a better subject with which to start this book. The Food Lab's Complete Guide to Buying and Storing Eggs. When I say eggs, I'm pretty much always referring to chicken eggs, by far the most prevalent type of avian egg in the world. But are all chicken eggs created equal? Do some taste better than others? What factors affect how they work in recipes, and how can I make sure to get the best out of them? Here are the answers to all those questions and more. Identification. What exactly is an egg? An egg is a vessel for the developing embryo of an animal that reproduces through sexual reproduction. In the culinary sense, we're usually referring to eggs from avian animals that are expelled from the body, like chicken eggs. What's inside the egg that makes it so culinarily useful? There are 2 basic parts to an egg, yolk and white. The yolk is the nutritive source for the developing embryo, and it accounts for about 75% of the calories in an egg. Yolks may appear rich and fatty, but in fact, they are essentially sacks of water that contain dissolved proteins, along with larger masses of protein and fat linked with lecithin, an emulsifying molecule that allows fat and water molecules to get along together harmoniously. We'll get back to that in a moment. The white is also mostly water, along with a few proteins, the most important being ovalbumin, ovomucin, and ovotransferrin, which give it its unique capacity to both set when cooked and be whipped into stiff, shaving cream-like peaks. Because the proteins in eggs are already dissolved and spread out in a liquid, it is very easy to incorporate them into other foods, much more than, say, meat proteins, which are relatively firmly set in place in relation to one another. Have you ever tried whipping a steak? I have. It doesn't work. Additionally, the fact that eggs contain such a wide variety of proteins, each of which behaves in a slightly different way when heat or mechanical action is applied, means that as a cook, you have great control over the final texture of your finished dish. Eggs cooked to 140 degrees Fahrenheit, for example, will be soft and custard-like, while those cooked to 180 degrees Fahrenheit will be bouncy and firm. Labeling, size, and quality. Eggs come in a few different sizes at the supermarket. Which one should I be reaching for? Any carton of eggs that displays the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, shield on it was packed according to USDA weight standards, which define six different classes. Weight class, jumbo, minimum weight per egg, 2.5 ounces. Weight class, extra large, minimum weight per egg, 2.25 ounces. Weight class, large, minimum weight per egg, 2 ounces. Weight class, medium, minimum weight per egg, 1.75 ounces. Weight class, small, minimum weight per egg, 1.5 ounces. Weight class, peewee, minimum weight per egg, 1.25 ounces. In reality, you're unlikely to see small or peewee eggs at the supermarket. Chickens these days are bred to produce eggs medium size and up. Large eggs are the standard in most recipes, including the ones in this book. I do like to have jumbo eggs on hand in my fridge, though, for those post-night-out mornings when I can really use that extra half ounce of fried egg to fill me up. You're also more likely to find one of the coveted double yolks in a larger egg. What about those letter grades on the side of the carton? Are grade A eggs better than grade B? Like sizing, grading of eggs is a voluntary action that most manufacturers choose to comply with in order to get the USDA stamp of approval on their boxes. USDA grading experts examine sample eggs from each batch to determine the grade based on the quality of the whites, yolks, and shells. Eggs with the firmest whites, tallest standing yolks, and cleanest shells will get a AA stamp, while eggs with watery whites, flat yolks, and stained shells receive a B. Grade A lies in the middle and is what most retail stores carry for consumers. As far as cooking quality goes, a firm white and yolk are important for things like poached eggs and fried eggs, where a nice, tight appearance is desired, but in most cooking or baking application, any grade'll do. It's a cosmetic difference alone. Egg freshness. You mentioned that lower-graded eggs have watery whites, and so will tend to spread out more than higher-graded ones. But doesn't freshness play a role in this too? Indeed, it does. Very fresh eggs have tighter yolks and whites that will hold their shape much better during poaching or frying, as well as yolks that will remain better centered when boiled. Because of the way their proteins break down, eggs become looser and looser as they age. There's another important change, too. As eggs age, they become more and more alkaline. This is particularly important in meringue-based dishes, as the pH of egg whites can greatly affect their foaming power. Egg whites foam best in slightly acidic environments, which means that old eggs will produce looser, wetter foams. To counteract this, a pinch of acidic cream of tartar will help your meringue stay stiff and weep-free. I've heard that older eggs are better for boiling because they are easier to peel. Is this true? Is there any culinary advantage to using older eggs? I believed this for the longest time until I actually tested it with a few cartons of eggs from different sources, comparing them with some eggs I got from my neighbor in Brooklyn's backyard that were less than a week old. Guess what? Whether the eggs were a week old or 2.5 months old, they were just as likely to have shells that stuck to them when peeling. On top of that, with older eggs, the yolks become uncentered, gravitating toward the egg wall, making for unattractive slices. No matter how you plan on cooking them, fresh eggs are better than old ones. Is there a trick to getting the shell off a hard-boiled egg without mutilating the white? I've tried every method known to man, ticking them off one at a time. Shocking the eggs in ice water? It makes no difference. Poking a hole in the shells before cooking them? Nope. Sorry. Steaming or pressure cooking them? Nuh-uh. Adding vinegar to the water? All that does is dissolve the outermost layer of shell. In fact, I discovered that the only thing that really seems to make a difference is the initial cooking phase. Drop the eggs into hot water, and they'll peel pretty easily, though even this doesn't work 100% of the time. Heat them up slowly, starting with cold water, and the egg proteins will end up fused to the inside of the shell. As far as the actual peeling process, the easiest way is to peel the still-hot eggs under cool running water, starting from the fat end where the air pocket is located. When the eggs are hot, the connection between the membrane and egg white is weaker, making it easier to remove the shell. The cool water not only helps gently dislodge stubborn bits of shell, it also prevents your fingers from getting burned. I put a fine mesh strainer or colander in the sink to catch the shells for easy cleanup. How do I know how old an egg is? You can try checking on the carton label, which will give you a rough idea. On pretty much every package of eggs, you'll see a sell-by date, as well as a pack date, also known as the Julian date, the date on which the eggs were inspected, cleaned, and placed in the carton. The pack date is the 3-digit number immediately above the sell-by date, starting with 001 for January 1st and ending at 365 for December 31st. Legally, the sell-by date can be no more than 45 days after the pack date, but when properly refrigerated, eggs will remain wholesome for well beyond this 45-day period. 60 to 70 days is reasonable. While it's possible that the eggs you're buying were laid within a few days of their pack date, manufacturers have up to 30 days to clean and pack eggs, which means that, in theory, if you buy a carton of eggs on its expiration date, it may already be 75 days old. Clearly, checking the expiration date is not the most reliable way to guarantee fresh eggs. You're much better off checking the pack date. What if I buy eggs without a pack date, or I've transferred the eggs to the egg compartment in my refrigerator door and no longer know the date? First off, everyone tells you that if you want to maximize shelf life, you should get those eggs out of the fridge door and into the coldest part of your fridge. True. But what they fail to tell you is that even on a shelf in the door, eggs will last for several weeks beyond their pack date. So unless you eat or cook with eggs only on very rare occasions, go ahead and keep them in the door. You'll use them up long before they go bad. That said, there's a quick and easy test to gauge the freshness of an egg. Just drop it into a bowl of water. Eggshells are porous. They can lose about 4 microliters of water a day to evaporation while simultaneously taking air into the space between the shell and the inner membrane near the fat end. In very fresh eggs, the air space is tiny and the egg will sink to the bottom of the bowl and lie on its side. As eggs get older, the air space will grow, so old eggs will sink and then stand on their points as the air in the larger end tries to rise. If you've got an egg that floats, it's probably past its prime and should be discarded. My local farmer's market sells unrefrigerated eggs, and I've seen some supermarkets in Europe where the eggs just sit out on shelves. Are they crazy, or is it me? Most likely, it's you. When eggs are first laid, they are covered in a thin, wax-like coating called the cuticle. This cuticle is the egg's first barrier against bacterial infection and excessive moisture loss. In the United States, USDA stamped eggs are all washed prior to packaging, a step that removes the cuticle. It may mean that our packaged eggs are cleaner to begin with, but it does mean that they have less protection against future bacterial infection as they sit in the supermarket. Refrigeration is necessary to help prevent this. But many eggs sold at farmers' markets or in European supermarkets have not been washed prior to packing. The cuticle remains intact, so refrigeration is unnecessary, but the eggs tend to have a shorter shelf life than refrigerated eggs. What about the pasteurized eggs I'm seeing on the market these days? Pasteurized eggs are a relatively new product. They are sterilized by submerging the eggs in a water bath at around 130 degrees Fahrenheit, a temperature that, given enough time, is hot enough to kill any harmful bacteria on or inside the egg, but cool enough that the egg won't cook. Pasteurized eggs are useful for people who like to eat their eggs runny or in raw preparations, like mayonnaise, but don't want to run the very minimal risk of getting sick from them. For most cooking purposes, pasteurized eggs will work fine, though you'll notice that the whites are runnier, making them difficult to poach or fry, and that they take about twice as long to whip into peaks. The yolks work just as well as those from regular eggs and mayonnaise or Caesar salad dressing. Is it true that brown eggs are healthier than white? Absolutely not. The color of the eggshell has to do with the breed of the chicken, and it is largely controlled by market demands. In most of New England, brown eggs are the norm, while the majority of the rest of the country prefers white eggs. They are completely interchangeable. Egg labeling. I miss the old days when I could walk into the supermarket and pick up a carton of eggs without feeling like I was making an important life decision. These days, there are dozens of varieties to choose from. What do all the labels mean? It is confusing, and it largely has to do with growing consumer awareness about the conditions in which egg-laying chickens are kept. Most spend their lives as little more than egg-producing machines, housed in batteries of individual cages, unable to spread their wings or even move, with little or no access to a space where a chicken could perform its natural behaviors. The label on the carton can be an indication of better welfare for the birds. Natural indicates that the eggs are minimally processed, but since all eggs are sold minimally processed, the label effectively means nothing. Similarly, the term farm fresh carries with it no guarantees, because presumably nobody is selling rotten eggs that don't come from a farm. Free range, free roaming, and cage-free eggs come from chickens that are not kept in battery cages, but instead in large open barns or warehouses. That is a major improvement in quality of life for the chickens, allowing them to engage in natural behaviors like pecking, dust bathing, and spreading their wings. Free range and free roaming chickens generally also have access to outdoor areas, but the labeling laws have no requirements as far as the size or quality of the area goes, nor for how long the chickens must be allowed out. Fact of the matter is, most of these chickens never set foot outside the barn. These labels are not audited. You're going on the word of the producer alone. Certified organic eggs come from chickens kept in open barns or warehouses with an unspecified degree of outdoor access. Again, for all intents and purposes, probably none. They must be fed an organic, all-vegetarian diet, free of animal byproducts, antibiotics, and pesticides, and farms are checked for compliance by the USDA. Certified humane eggs have been verified by third-party auditors, and this label requires stricter controls on stocking densities, given the chickens more space and the ability to engage in natural behaviors like nesting and perching. Producers are not allowed to engage in forced molting, the practice of inducing hens into a laying cycle by starving them. This practice is allowed for all other types of eggs. Omega-3 enriched eggs come from chickens that have been fed supplements made from flaxseed or fish oil to increase the levels of omega-3 fatty acid, an essential fatty acid touted with several health benefits, in their yolks. While some people claim eggs high in omega-3s have a fishy aroma, in blind tastings, I found no significant differences in the way these eggs taste. If animal welfare is a concern, you are making a good step in the right direction by purchasing only certified organic or certified humane eggs. If you've got a local farmer's market where you can actually talk to the farmer producing the eggs you're purchasing, you're making an even better decision. Of course, the very best thing you can do is to build your own coop, or better yet, convince your neighbor to do so, and keep a couple chickens. It won't save you much money in the long run, unless you keep a large flock and eat a lot of eggs, but you'll have the freshest possible eggs and probably make plenty of friends in the process. That's all well and good for the chickens, but do certified organic or local eggs taste better, like the guys at the farmer's market would like you to think? That's a good question, and one that I've wondered often about. It seems natural that a happier, healthier chicken roaming around a backyard, poking, scratching, eating bugs and worms, clucking, and doing all the charming and funny things chickens do should produce tastier eggs, right? I mean, I know that some of the best-tasting eggs I've ever eaten have come fresh out of the coops or backyards of friends who keep their own flocks. The yolks were richer, the whites tighter and more flavorful, and it was just an all-around better experience. Or was it? What if all their greatness was simply in my head? To test this, I organized a blind tasting in which I had tasters taste regular supermarket eggs, plain organic eggs with varying levels of omega-3, and eggs fresh from 100% free-roaming, pasture-raised chickens. All of the eggs were served scrambled. The results? Indeed, the pastured eggs and omega-3 enriched eggs fared better than the standard supermarket eggs. But I also noticed another correlation. The color of the eggs varied quite a bit, with the pastured eggs on the more intensely orange end of the spectrum. And the more omega-3s the eggs contained, the deeper orange the yolk. The plain organic eggs and standard factory eggs were the palest of the lot. This difference in pigmentation can be attributed to the varying diets of the chickens. Pastured hens eat bugs and flowers, both of which contribute color to yolks. Chickens bred for eggs with high omega-3 acids are fed with a diet enriched with flax seeds and sea kelp, which contribute color. Chickens that lay these more expensive eggs are also sometimes fed pigmented supplements, like marigold leaves, that make their yolks nice and bright. Could it be that the flavor differences tasters were reporting had more to do with their reaction to the color than to the actual flavor of the egg? In order to eliminate color as a variable, I cooked up the same kinds of eggs, this time dyeing them green with some food coloring. When I readministered the tasting with green eggs, there was absolutely no correlation between flavor and provenance. People liked the regular supermarket eggs just as much as the eggs that had come straight from the pasture. The old saying that you eat with your eyes? It's true. So you're telling me that it doesn't matter at all where I get my eggs from? No, I'm not saying that at all. Our minds are extraordinarily powerful, and our taste preferences have as much to do with our mental biases and upbringings as they do with real measurable physical characteristics in the food. You've probably noticed it yourself. Doesn't an ice-cold beer taste better when you're drinking it with friends on an outdoor patio on a warm summer evening than on those lonely nights when you're drinking solo? Doesn't the atmosphere and service in a restaurant affect the flavor of the food in your mind? Do you really think that your mom's apple pie is better than anyone else's? Chances are, the reason you like it so much is because it's your mom making it. The combination of physical appearance, weather, company, atmosphere, and even your mood can affect the flavor of food. I like to think of it this way. I'm going to continue eating the freshest eggs I can find, produced by the most humanely raised chickens, because I care a bit about the chickens' well-being. The fact that my mind tricks me into thinking these eggs actually taste better is just icing on the cake. You mean I get to do the right thing and my eggs will taste better? Yes, please. One more advantage. Eggs bought directly from the farmer at a farmer's market are generally much fresher. I've managed to buy eggs that had been laid the day they were sold, making them better to cook with and much easier to poach or fry. Boiled eggs. Boiled eggs are about the simplest recipe in any cook's repertoire, right? But how often do you get truly perfect boiled eggs? Hard-boiled eggs should have fully set but not rubbery whites surrounding yolks that are cooked through but still bright yellow and creamy, with no hint of chalkiness or crumbling, and certainly none of that dreaded sulfurous green tinge at the yolk-white interface that overcooked eggs acquire. Soft-boiled eggs, on the other hand, should have fully set whites with liquid yolks that ooze out like a soft custard, bathing your toast in their golden flow and enriching your crisp bacon. There's more to boiling an egg than meets the eye. Much more. Nearly every basic cookbook offers a different technique for how it should be done. Start the egg in cold water or gently lower it into boiling water. Add vinegar to the water to lower its pH or add baking soda to the water to raise it. Cover the pot or don't cover it. Use old eggs or use new eggs, and on and on. But very few offer evidence as to why any one of these techniques should work any better than another. Apparently, boiling eggs is not an exact science. Let's try and change that. What is boiling? First things first, what exactly is boiling? The technical definition is that it is what occurs when the vapor pressure of a liquid is greater than or equal to the atmospheric pressure that surrounds it. Let's go back to the chicken coop analogy we used earlier. Your pot of water is a coop full of chickens. The chickens tend to like each other and happily stick together inside the coop. Now, let's say we start adding energy to the mix by switching their water supply out with coffee. With the added energy, the chickens begin to become hyperactive. One or two of them might even be so energetic as to be able to jump the fence and escape. Add enough energy to the mix, and eventually the chickens will become so hyperactive that they'll tear down the fence and begin escaping very rapidly indeed. Boiling water is the same thing. The water molecules are trapped in the pot and kept in place by their own fence, the pressure of the air in the atmosphere pushing down on them. Add energy to the pot in the form of heat, and water molecules begin to start leaping off the surface of the water. This is called evaporation. Eventually, the pressure produced by the water molecules trying to escape becomes equal to or greater than the pressure of the atmosphere pushing down on it. The fence breaks, the floodgates open, and water molecules rapidly jump from a liquid state to gas, bubbling up violently. This conversion of liquid water to water vapor, steam, is what you see when you look at a pot of boiling water. With pure water at sea level, this occurs at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. Here's a quick rundown of what happens when you bring a pot of water to a boil. Quivering. At between 130 and 170 degrees Fahrenheit, tiny bubbles of water vapor begin forming at nucleation sites, more on those later, along the bottom and sides of the pot. They won't be large enough to actually jump and rise to the surface of the water, but their formation will cause the top surface to quiver a bit. Subsimmer. At between 170 degrees and 195 degrees Fahrenheit, the bubbles from the sides and bottom of the pot begin to rise to the surface. Usually, you'll see a couple of streams of tiny, champagne-like bubbles rising from the bottom of the pot. For the most part, however, the liquid is still relatively still. Simmer. At between 195 degrees and 212 degrees Fahrenheit, bubbles break the surface of the water regularly and from all points, not just a few individual streams, as in a subsimmer. Full boil. At 212 degrees Fahrenheit, bubbles of water vapor escape extremely rapidly. This is the hottest that water can get at sea level without the aid of a pressure cooker. Heat and eggs. Though some people claim that adding salt, vinegar, or baking soda to the water when you boil an egg can affect its final texture, in my testing, I found that the only factors that matter when boiling an egg in its shell are time and temperature. To find out exactly how fast an egg cooks in boiling water, I cooked 12.5 eggs, removing them from the pot at 30-second intervals before splitting them open. Now, there are a few things you'll notice immediately. First, and most obvious, is that the longer you keep an egg in boiling water, the hotter it gets. But here's something more important, which may seem trivial at first, yet, as we'll see, is instrumental in a perfectly cooked egg. Foods in a hot environment cook from the outside in, and the bigger the temperature differential between the food and the environment, the more uneven the cooking will be. What this means is that if you lower an egg into boiling water, it's possible to achieve an end result with a white that's tough, rubbery, and overcooked, while the yolk is still just barely cooked in the center, like a bad egg located in the bonus PDF. So what's the ideal temperature to cook an egg to? Here's what happens to an egg white as it heats up. From 130 degrees to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. As the white gets hot, its proteins, which resemble coiled balls of yarn, slowly start to uncoil. At 140 degrees Fahrenheit, one of these uncoiled proteins, ovotransferrin, begins to bond with itself, creating a semi-solid matrix that turns the egg white milky and jelly-like. At 155 degrees Fahrenheit, the ovotransferrin has formed an opaque solid, though it is still quite soft and moist. At 180 degrees Fahrenheit, the main protein in the egg white, ovalbumin, will cross-link and solidify, giving you a totally firm but still tender white. Beyond 180 degrees Fahrenheit, the hotter you get the egg, the more tightly the egg proteins bond, and the firmer, drier, and more rubbery the egg white becomes. Eventually, hydrogen sulfide, or that rotten egg aroma, begins to develop. Congratulations, your egg is overcooked. An egg yolk follows a different set of temperatures. At 145 degrees Fahrenheit, the yolk proteins begin to denature, thickening the liquid yolk. At 158 degrees Fahrenheit, the egg yolk is firm, able to hold its shape, and to be cut with a fork or knife. Its appearance is still dark and translucent, with an almost fudge-like texture. Between 158 degrees and 170 degrees Fahrenheit, the yolk becomes firmer and firmer until eventually it suddenly shifts from translucent and fudge-like to pale yellow and crumbly as tiny spherical chambers invisible to the naked eye separate from each other. Above 170 degrees Fahrenheit, the yolk becomes increasingly crumbly as the temperature goes up. The sulfur in the white rapidly reacts with the iron in the yolk, creating ferrous sulfide, tinging the outside of the yolk an unattractive green. Boiling eggs is all about balancing the differences between the way the whites and the yolks cook. Soft-boiled eggs. For me, the ideal soft-boiled egg has a white that's completely opaque, but not to the point of rubberiness, somewhere in the range of 155 degrees to 180 degrees Fahrenheit, and a yolk that's pretty much 100% liquid, no hotter than 158 degrees Fahrenheit. In this way, with each spoonful, you get tender bites of soft, velvety-smooth white bathed in a sauce of glorious, bright golden, rich, flavorful yolk. So, remembering that foods cook from the outside in, and that the hotter your cooking environment, the greater the temperature gradient that forms in your egg, you realize that for soft-boiled eggs, you want to start with cold eggs and submerge them in hot water so that the whites cook and set while the yolks remain liquidy. I tried plunging the eggs directly into boiling water to cook until the whites were just set, but I ran into a problem. The outermost layers of the whites end up slightly overcooking. A much better way to do it is to bring a pot of water to a boil, shut off the heat, drop the eggs into it, cover the pot to help it retain some heat, and then start the timer. Since the water in the pot gets cooler as it sits, the eggs stand much less of a chance of overcooking and turning rubbery. The other important thing to consider is the ratio of water to eggs. Add too many eggs, and they'll cool the water down so much that they won't cook properly. So, 3 quarts is enough water to cook up to 6 eggs. Any more than that, and you'll want to cook in batches or in a larger pot. Hard-boiled eggs. Hard-boiled eggs are a little more complicated. The goal is to have both the white and yolk at the point where they are opaque but not rubbery. The truly obsessive kitchen nerd's way to do it is to maintain the water at precisely 170 degrees Fahrenheit so that the yolk comes out perfectly cooked and the white is still tender. And this method works. It's also a major pain in the butt. Luckily, there's an easier way. We already know that if we drop the eggs directly into boiling water, the exterior heats up much faster than the interior, so that by the time the very center of the yolk reaches 170 degrees Fahrenheit, the white and outer layers of yolk are hopelessly overcooked. You might be inclined to put the eggs in cold water and bring them to a boil gradually. This method works, but there's a problem. It causes the eggs to fuse to the shells. So, cooking them gently gives you even results, but cooking them fast makes it easier to remove the shell. What I needed was a technique that bridged both of these. What if I were to start the eggs in a precise volume of boiling water and let them cook just long enough so that the whites set but remain separated from the shells, then lower the temperature of the water rapidly by adding a few ice cubes and finish cooking them? It took a few dozen tries to get the exact timing and ice measurements down correctly, but guess what? It works. By using a fast start and a slow and steady cook to the end, you consistently get eggs that are both perfectly cooked through and through and easy to peel. Foolproof hard-boiled eggs. Note: depending on how hot your kitchen is and your cookware's